and I think about what it takes for my clients to pack up their lives and cross borders with their children with so much uncertainty, fleeing violence and other life-threatening situations. And then I think, well, you know, my clients are resilient. I have to respect that and remember that about them. And I have to respect the role I play in this really unjust and difficult system. My name is Susie Pritchett. I'm currently the Executive Director of Clinics and Experiential Learning at Drake University Law School. Prior to accepting this position at Drake, I was running an immigration and international human rights clinic at the University of Wyoming, where we would regularly represent asylum seekers in their request for asylum before the United States government.
This feels like a time of really accelerated activity among all of my friends who are immigration attorneys and are dealing with immigration and refugee issues.
I would say the one defining characteristic of this administration's approach to immigration is creating a climate of fear through destabilization. And what I mean by that is that, you know, for so long we have had immigration law on the books and then, you know, immigration policy and prosecution as various executives have made immigration a priority in certain individuals within our system, a priority for deportation. And Obama, to the extent that he was known as the deporter in chief, he deported a lot of people, but he really was very clear about using the government's limited resources with respect to who it could remove from this country realistically, and said, well, let's go after people who are repeat violators of SWIFT, people who have very serious criminal records, and let's let all the people who are living their lives and working and trying to just pursue the American dream, you know, those people are going to be pretty low priority, if not a priority at all. And we saw him enacting policies like DACA for the Dreamers and DAPA, which was the proposed executive order related to allowing undocumented non-citizens who had U.S. citizen children some form of immigration reprieve. And so the message that was sent from the Obama administration was, we're going to be tough on those who have shown that they are not willing to abide by our laws and, you know, fulfill the roles of good citizens in our country. But for everyone else, we're going to try and, you know, if not pave the path for you to some sort of permanent status, create a climate in which you feel like you're welcome here. Since Trump has become president, all of that has been completely turned on its head. And he now has basically said anybody who is here without proper authorization is a priority for deportation. So that alone has created a massive amount of fear in the immigrant community. And then every day it's something new, right? It seems like it's something new. It was the travel ban, and then it was the overthrow or the reversal of DACA, or the attempted reversal. Then it was the family separation policy. And now we see people who are U.S. citizens who thought they absolutely had no problem. We see the government going back and trying to undo citizenship or questioning whether or not individuals who got citizenship have lawfully gotten it. So all these things that were once, not issues or not necessarily hot button topics, you know, people who thought they were here safely or people who thought they could live here without a massive threat of deportation, suddenly everyone's on the radar. And I honestly believe that this is part of a larger policy to create a climate of fear, both, I think, for political means, right, to stir up a certain political base in the United States that really thinks people who are here without undocumented, who are here in an undocumented status, should all be deported, but also in an effort to help get people to just self-deport or to not even attempt to come to the United States to begin with. You know, to the extent that We have people who have their green cards who, for a while there, it wasn't clear if they were on vacation when the travel ban was put in effect, if they would even be able to get back into the country. Or, you know, I have a lot of people coming to me who've had green cards for a long time who haven't naturalized for one reason or another, who are suddenly saying, before I felt fine just holding a green card and I had no intention of naturalizing, but now the very foundation of my status here feels under threat, and you know, I want to go ahead and naturalize to become a U.S. citizen. Some of the very basic ideas that are, you know, enshrined in our Constitution are being called into question. That, you know, I've heard Trump say we should get rid of birthright citizenship. You know, the idea that being born on U.S. soil confers U.S. citizenship on you. I mean, I think at one point he was saying that should be called into question. So it's nothing feels sacred or safe from attack under this administration.
The effect of that, which you've written about, you know, one of the effects of that is that a whole lot of other government operations become chaotic as well, such as trying to get witnesses for crimes. And so it bleeds into all of this other policy that's going on, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I mean, we see this fight taking place between Trump and the sanctuary jurisdictions, right? When local and state law enforcement has said, we don't want to be ICE. We don't want to play ICE. We're not going to help ICE enforce the immigration laws. And therefore, you know, because police in state and local jurisdictions know that they need immigrants to feel safe in their communities. They need immigrant cooperation in prosecution. They need immigrant cooperation in investigations. And that by playing the role of ICE, it doesn't make communities safer. It in fact makes them less safe. And so to the extent local and state municipalities have stood up and said, we're not going to cooperate with ICE, then Trump has turned around and threatened to withdraw funding to them, federal funding, as a way to kind of coerce their compliance into this larger enforcement scheme. And that, of course, has been challenged through litigation, but it's certainly another way that we see the kind of national immigration policies trickling down and having a local effect all the way into, you know, your jail down the street in your small town, or the courtroom where an undocumented person has maybe been the victim of crime and serves as a witness in their case.
The processing of asylum and even the way that the administration seems to be thinking of asylum seems to have radically changed as well.
Yeah, I mean, I just one example. There's many, but one example that I'm dealing with and working on is the recent decision from the Attorney General to certify a case from 2014 at the Board of Immigration Appeals, which was the case called Matter of ARCG, that established that domestic violence could be a viable basis for a claim for asylum. Just recently, I think it was in May or June, the Attorney General certified that decision to himself and completely overturned that and said, you know, basically any private act of violence like domestic violence or also gang violence cannot be serve as the basis for a successful asylum claim. And so, you know, that's a massive, massive swath of people who otherwise would have had a pathway to permanent status through our asylum regime, now having that foreclosed, absent more creative advocacy to try and find the holes that are left after the Attorney General's decision. So, you know, our asylum system, to the extent we thought it provided protection to certain people and certain types of harm, they're also trying to close the door on the number of people who are protected under our international obligations pursuant to the Refugee Convention. You know, when I'm teaching students about immigration law, and particularly when I'm supervising students in a clinical setting who are working on asylum cases or other immigration cases, we joke, but it's actually quite true that you're basically trying death penalty cases in traffic court, right? I mean, the state in asylum claims certainly are incredibly high, to the extent that if somebody is deported back to a place where their life is at stake, you know, that is a life or death determination that's being made. And so the human aspect could not be more palpable. And certainly, you know, I've had clients who are just terrified to go to the hospital because they're not sure what's going to happen there. I have clients who are on ICE monitoring systems because they've been released on parole. They'll have to check in with ICE, and they never know if the next time they check in, they're going to be swept up and deported. I have clients who we filed a brief in their case based on matter of ARCG because they are victims of domestic violence, who I have to now say, your case is much less strong. And where before I felt quite confident about our ability to make a successful asylum claim, it's become 100 times harder. And I don't know, you know, you never can guarantee the outcome, but it's become much more bleak for a number of women, usually women with children who are with them here in the United States, who have claims of asylum based on domestic violence. It's really much harder to even give them good advice because everything's been so destabilized, and you know, not knowing what's going to happen at your next court hearing is always difficult. But to know that now the law is no longer on your side is just absolutely terrifying.
How do you personally absorb and kind of work through all of this with all of that gravity?
That's a really great question. And I think that, you know, I have slowly learned the hard lesson over time that I can't bear the weight of the systemic injustices that we're up against here alone, right? And I found myself feeling responsible. Like, I am a middle-class, educated white person who somehow is responsible for the system we have in place, right? And therefore, I have sole responsibility to fight against it. But I have to continually remind myself at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of systemic injustices that are beyond my ability to fight as a single attorney, but also that our clients are really resilient, you know, and humans are really resilient. And I think about what it takes for my clients to pack up their lives and cross borders with their children with so much uncertainty, fleeing violence and other life-threatening situations. And I think, well, you know, my clients are resilient. I have to respect that and remember that about them. And I have to respect the role I play in this really unjust and difficult system and know that I can do my best, but I might not be, you know, solving the world's problems, certainly not. And I might not be able to win every case. And at the end of the day, I just have to hope that my client's resiliency sees them through that as well.
Maybe it makes it slightly easier and slightly more heartening to see just all of the people in your profession, in your field, who've risen up, because it seems like there's tons of organizations and individual practitioners. And so that's why I was going to ask you, you know, who are the heroes? Who are the people in your field and the organizations in your field that you really find inspiring?
One thing that I was so heartened by. So just a quick rewind. I remember waking up the day after the election, after President Trump was elected, and having this massive realization that I walked in around in a world where almost half the people I encountered totally thought the exact opposite of everything I think. And I was in a cloud before that. I really honestly conducted myself in the world as though most people I encountered thought the same way I did. And it was gross naivete to think that. And it was such a rude awakening to kind of wake up on that November day and say, oh my gosh, I've been living a lie. But then I see things like the Raicists fundraiser on Facebook, right? Which I think raised, I don't know how many millions of dollars, and just the outpouring of support for people to organizations like that. So I think there's, you know, when I think of heroes, I think of the individuals who maybe don't have an immigrant in their life, or those individuals who really have no other connection to the immigration system, but can understand humanity enough to make a donation to RAISES to start addressing the family separation problem. I think about, you know, the lawyers who are working in the nonprofits who are, you know, getting paid very little compared to somebody who's in a white shoe law firm in New York City, but working nights and weekends. Law firm or organizations like Catholic Charities, like the organizations that do refugee resettlement, organizations that like the ACLU, who are pushing the boundaries of litigation and the law on the travel ban on DACA rescission. But I, you know, I also have to give a shout out to my fellow clinicians around the country who really were both privileged to be in academic environments that give us some space to also, you know, make our voices heard and to fight back against some of these restrictionist immigration policies, but to train the next generation of immigration attorneys who are going to continue this fight into the future. So, you know, it's people from the individuals making their $20 donations to an issue that, you know, they care about because they're humans and they see their own lives reflected in the lives of families being separated at the border, all the way to the ivory tower, where we've got clinics doing some really amazing work and keeping the administration accountable to whatever extent we can. So two things that I would do tomorrow, and they're surely not going to solve all the problems, but these are my two magic wand moments. I would find that deportation is in fact a punishment, and much like in the criminal context, require that every single person who is facing deportation is entitled to an attorney at the government's expense. I mean, it's just absolutely mind-boggling that we have children going in front of immigration courts and judges expected to present a case themselves, right? Immigration law is one of the most complicated laws on the books, and the fact we ask people to navigate this without representation, you know, regularly, it's a complete systemic nightmare. So that would be number one. And number two, I would make immigration judges, Article 3 judges. At the moment, immigration judges are just governmental employees under the Department of Justice, meaning that they can be hired and fired by the Attorney General as he sees fit. And right now, the Attorney General is pressuring immigration judges and influencing the outcome in how cases are heard. So I think moving immigration judges out of the executive branch and into the judicial branch and giving them independence and allowing them to make decisions that they are free to make without threat of loss of their job or some sort of punishment from the AG would make our system more free and fair, and I think ultimately would work to the betterment of the system as a whole.
I'm Audette Fulbright-Fulson. Right now, I serve as the Associate Minister at the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City. I am in almost my 20th year of ministry, so I've served congregations throughout the South and then a little while out your way. I was in Cheyenne, Wyoming prior to coming to New York City. Mm-hmm. I also do a number of things in anti-racism and congregational work, sort of writ large, over time, things like being a good officer for our UU Ministers Association and things like that, which the reason I mention it is because it gives me that chance to work between congregations and directly with ministers, including ministers in formation and things like that. And that's work that I dearly love.
Mm-hmm. You also host a really fine podcast called Reverence Road, in which you interview just some of the fantastic, really like kind of amazing people in your congregation there.
It is a true joy. And it's possible because I have this amazing producer named Matt Sannard, and he makes my work pop and come together in the end. And I'm really grateful for that.
So recently you went down to, it was San Diego, right?
It was San Diego.
Landed in and then did border work there. And I know that there is ongoing work with several faith organizations. And as usual, the UUs are part of the vanguard, really, of that movement down there. Why don't you tell us about what you did personally? And if you wanted to talk about some of the larger context or longer term engagement, you're welcome to do that as well.
Well, so there was a national clergy call that went out from the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee and others in the area, Quakers and others that were doing work down there at the border. San Diego is a locus of a lot of the border work, and they put out a clergy call for, it wasn't for very long. We had somewhere between 3 or 5 weeks notice. I don't think it was as much as 5 weeks. It's getting a little fuzzy in my rearview mirror, I'm afraid, but it gave me the chance to say, okay, yes, this is super important. I want to answer this call. The goal of this particular action was very specific. Immigration issues had, in the mix of everything that's going on, had become a little occluded by other, for example, heinous crimes being committed by the current administration. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to make sure that attention was remaining on the issue. This was in the few weeks following the tear gassing and other events that happened there at the border. And so what they wanted to do was ask clergy and people of faith to come to this border action, and its specific purpose was to draw moral attention to what was happening, as opposed to, in many cases, of course, that the work we want to do at the border is directly to help people seeking asylum, fleeing, trying to cross the border for reasons of safety. And so this was not a direct service action. This was a moral attention action. And in fact, it was quite beautiful. Hundreds and hundreds of clergy of all different faith traditions did show up for this action. And what struck me were several things. One was that they were very careful, the leaders of the action were very careful on a couple of points. First of all, if you were going to risk arrest, sort of under their aegis, under this event that they had planned, they insisted that you show up first for their training so that they could better ensure that you could be safe as possible, which is not that safe in sure. this process, and also so you could make choices that were based on clear awareness of various factors that might affect, for example, whether you were kept in detention or booked and released and things like that. Plus, they also wanted to have a very careful count and awareness of those people who might be arrested so they could prepare help for anyone who was detained or arrested. So the training happened that weekend. I had pulpit duties on that Sunday, and so I wasn't able to go to any of the weekend trainings, which immediately excluded me from the possibility of arrest or detention, at least that they would, you know, consider me one of their own. So I was among those who were witnessing and doing holding and witnessing actions outside of those who were being risking arrest. So first of all, they were really intentional in that way to make sure their people were prepared. The other was that they wanted to make sure that the attention was on people of faith talking about that moral responsibility and leadership among religious leaders, but also encouraging political and other community leaders to really reclaim the moral center of how the United States should treat asylees and immigrants and people seeking to enter the United States. We've come quite a long way from, we've never been perfect by any measure on these issues, but it's just continually degrading, and it's entered a particularly heinous spiral during this recent window of a couple of years. So they also didn't tell us things like where we were going specifically. They held that very close so that as much as possible, the authorities wouldn't have an ability to know where we were going and set up additional barriers to our work. So we all went first to a UU church there in San Diego, where we gathered and prepared, and we prayed first there, but then we all caravaned. They had buses that took the majority of us, and then there were some caravans of cars and other vehicles to get everyone to the location. And on site, we had a press conference where there was a lot of prayer, some really amazing speeches from different faith leaders. I was particularly touched by, and unfortunately, I can't remember the names because, you know, we were all just there trying to be present, and I wasn't writing things sure. down or capturing them. But an imam gave an amazing speech. We had a number of native elders who were, everyone was and had been asked to be in their appropriate religious garb as much as possible, considering that we were going to be marching on the beach. And pretty much all of us did show up in, you know, as much of our full religious clothing as we could, so that the images of that would be striking. We wanted people to be able at a glance to see the range of religious community that was showing up to say no and not in our name, and we believe that this is the wrong way to go about things. So after that press conference, we took a really long walk. It was a couple of miles, and then we were going out to what was once called Friendship Park. I mean, technically it still is, but it's where the border is. And they've put up razor wire. There are sort of two fields that we were acting on. The original intention was that especially the people who were risking arrest would go up to the actual border fence there and pray with people who might have gathered on the other side. What we discovered as we walked to the location was that there was the razor wire and other additional fencing some yards away from the border fence, you know, in front of us from where we were coming from. And we needed to keep essentially two clear zones. The first was for those people who were not risking arrest, we had to stand, I think it was like 100 yards back from the razor wire fence, which additionally was about at least 50 yards from the border fence. Does that make sense? And is that clear?
Yes. As clear, I think, as can be. I at least have a picture in my mind of what you're describing.
Right. And so if you're there, what you're looking at is two sets of fencing that run down into the water, into the ocean, actually. One is the border fence itself, which has narrow slats, and then closer to us on the sand coming from the direction we were coming from on the San Diego side, the razor wire fence that also extended down into the surf. And so we had to stay clear on the razor wire fence, San Diego side, about 100 feet. And those people risking arrest walked up. There was one patch where the razor wire was not intact so that you could, in theory, approach the border fence. And they had military police there. These were a number of people in full garb, including machine guns and, you know, riot gear. It looked surreal to be religious people just facing hugely armored guards with weapons of essentially mass destruction for humans. Mm-hmm. And then a fairly substantial number of people began to try to approach the border fence. Now, there are some really difficult rules about what happens then, because if you, as a person who is committing civil disobedience by, for example, we were told we could not pass the area and approach the border fence, and if we did, you know, we would be in violation. They called it a constitution-free zone, which I think is something that should alarm all of us greatly, as you can imagine.
Yeah, and holy shit, really?
Yeah, constitution-free zone between the razor wire and the border
fence. Who called it? Like, who's using that language?
I would have to track that down again. I'm not sure. It was common, you know, it was
just a sort of common knowledge that.
Right. That it was talked about freely and with great horror, right? People were saying, how can this be? It's that that can't be a thing. But it was my takeaway from the from what we were experiencing and being taught and what was being talked about in the training, that however it is done, that space has been designated essentially as not United States, not Mexico, and not governed by our Constitution. And I can't even imagine. Yeah, I can't even imagine.
Fascinating.
So, for example, if you approach that area and then you touch in any manner one of the officers that are guarding that space, that's assault. And it's a crime that's prosecuted quite differently, as you can imagine, from trespassing or civil disobedience of other kind. And one of the techniques that is used pretty regularly is to bump or, you know, something else to happen whereby a civilian touches one of those officers and then can be arrested and detained on those assault charges. And indeed, the person who was one of our chief organizers was arrested under assault charges. Now, there's video of all of this, as you can imagine, because we were all taking pictures and taking videos and recording. And there were also people from the national press around. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty obvious that what happened was he had a sort of a stumbling moment and ended up bumping into somebody, but he was taken away and he was the only one who was arrested and detained, and we did not know where he was for more than 24 hours for sure, because I was back, I think, in New York when I was trying to call and, you know, put pressure that we should find out where he is and have him released. But when our leaders couldn't enter that quote-unquote constitution-free zone and approach the border fence where they were going to pray, we, the witnesses, began singing, and they sang and kneeled and prayed in front of the officers. The images from it are very striking because it is a very, I think, a accurately representative sense of our moment to see a heavily, heavily, wildly disproportionately armed, militarized police person standing, guarding a constitution-free zone while the religious leaders of this country kneel to pray and beg to be allowed to approach the people whose lives we long to be a blessing to, that we want to be able to help shelter them, to welcome them, to see how their needs can be met. That's what we believe is not only our religious duty, but also what makes the United States, in whatever greatness we have had, that would be it, right? To welcome the stranger and to insist on incorporating people from all over the world, especially if they need us. Mm-hmm. So that was the moral power of the gathering. It went on for several hours. Many people were arrested, and then, as is fairly common, they would be sort of booked and released, a little catch and release program for religious people right there on site. And they have to then if you, for example, aren't from San Diego, you have to deal with whatever may come from having to come back to deal with your case and things like that. But it was a powerful morning. I think it did what we hoped it would do in that moment, but we live in such a time when there are so many crimes and malfeasances and evil actions, especially as regards our immigrant friends and family, that it gets washed away quite quickly. I think the fact that it happened on a beach where the tide rises and falls was a perfect metaphor for how quickly and yet persistently any action and the problem itself exists. So let me pause there and see if instead you have any questions or anything I can build out on.
I do. Or I want to ask a little bit about faith. I feel like there is this struggle about the material complacency of a lot of folks, people for whom confrontational politics is not a comfort zone. And I think about the call, the people I know who are going to the border and who are doing so as people of faith. And I wonder how we can call more people of faith to do this. Trying to describe maybe the way that faith can be a revolutionary experience for people.
The way in which faith can be a revolutionary experience for people. I mean, I think you've hit on the heart of what is the burning core for so many people. And, you know, I think in Unitarian Universalism, for example, we know how the wealth, power, and privilege from which we have come historically and contemporaneously lends itself to maintaining the status quo and keeping a remove of any number of kinds. And it does remind me, for example, of the current struggle or the current wrestling match that we see, for example, in democratic politics right now, when you have the newer folk who are coming in, who have a different kind of passion and are being labeled as so radical or what have you by more moderate folks who've been there for longer, who may have some institutional knowledge, and we're right. Wrestling to find the way forward through all of that. And that's the life of religious communities too, a lot of the time. If I understand your question, it is something about how do we help more people, either who are already among us as religious people or who might be drawn to us as religious people, have a fire where they are willing to risk much to change the world in the direction of our hope and aspirations.
Sure.
Is that
essentially
it? And it is the continuous question. Speaking of continuous question, you know, right now, for example, I'm pursuing another degree, I hope, trying to get more on the ground with that question. For me, one of the things I've noticed, though, is both in myself, for example, but in others as well, a lot of times we don't know how to do it. We don't understand what information to take in and then act on. And we've had a long, long period of where the majority of the public has been living in a peacetime situation, and mm-hmm. only a specialized few have been sent to suffer and die in the wars and conflicts that we constantly maintain. So people don't know how to show up or where or what it looks like to give themselves more completely. Now, in this current era, we've seen women begin to change and show up and talk about their experience in a very different way. And I think when we realized that the Trump administration was tearing children away from their parents and caregivers, many, many people were moved to try to do something. I know for a fact people were like, where can I go? How can I show up? And sometimes the question is just knowing where to go and where to show up, right? It's hard to determine that answer so much of the time, especially if, for example, you don't live in Washington, D.C., or you're not in a border community.
There are conduits in place and people in place and structures in place that have been established over time that sort of give people that path that they can take if that is the social action that they're called to do.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. And, you know, we are happily not alone in that effort. But for example, when I went to the border, I didn't have a lot of time to try to see if any of my congregants or others could go. But one of the things that emerges very quickly is the amount of relative privilege that is needed either to afford to travel to one of these places or to take the time, the ability to either take your children or be away from your children if you have them. You know, there are a lot of complicated issues that also prevent people from being able to show up in an embodied sense. We have to have different ways for people to be involved too, so that the introvert right. or the person whose body can't move into spaces of danger, have ways to engage, as well as the people who, for any number of reasons, can show up and are willing to do so.